Blog Talk Radio.
Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. It's not warm when she's away. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. She's always gone too long. Anytime she goes away.
Went away she did last night. Oh, so close. But the Patriots came up short, and it's fly, Eagles, fly. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Inside the Octagon. I'm your host, Kalani Lua. I got my calls, Leo Showers, on the mic with me. Leo, what's going on with you, brother?
What's happening, brother? I think ain't no sunshine for Priscilla Cachoeira if it were up to Mario Yamasaki, if you know what I'm saying.
Oh, man, we are going to get into that indeed. But I think we definitely have to address what recently just happened, what most people watched last night, the Super Bowl. Tremendous, tremendous game. A lot better than what I think many people saw it coming out as. And the Philadelphia Eagles, for the first time in franchise history, earned a Super Bowl in a very hard-fought, down-to-the-last-play battle against the defending champs, the New England Patriots. If this was in the UFC, we would have heard Bruce Buffer say, "And no." What did you make of yesterday's game, my man? And any takeaways from the game, the halftime show, commercials, anything at all?
Yeah, I thought the game itself was actually pretty entertaining. I think that probably was the first full NFL game that I saw all season. And all I really was hoping for was something close, you know, a game where the referees would let him play. And there really weren't very many flags. And it was exciting. There was like, what, one punt throughout the whole game. So it was a back-and-forth game. I was really, really hoping to see Tom Brady just, you know, basically establish his greatness of all time, you know, on top of everything he's already done. But at the same time, I'm really happy for the Eagles to finally get one championship. I mean, they deserve it. So I'm happy for them as well, and I'm happy that it was a pretty entertaining game.
Yeah, as a Raiders fan, I cannot side on the side of Tom Brady and the evil empire that is the New England Patriots. I don't care what nobody says, the goddamn Tuck rule. But in all fairness, just being a sports fan, it was a tremendous game. And in the back of my mind, I was thinking, y'all left too much time on the clock. Miracle Tom Brady's going to come down and do what he always does. And he almost did anyways. I got my dog sitting here trying to tell me no, that's not the case. So, sorry about that. But it was fun to see the game play out the way that it did, for the Eagles to get the victory. And you know what? You got to give them all the credit. I truly feel like this wasn't a game of somebody didn't deserve it. You know, it wasn't one of those cases, well, oh, the Patriots didn't play at the par, or the Eagles just got lucky. No, they went out there and executed a perfect game plan. And to tell you the truth, I'm looking forward to seeing how next year turns about with all the changes and whatnot coming around. Real quick, before we get on to actual MMA news, I want to ask you something. What did you make of the commercials? They seemed a little down these past couple of years. I'm not sure what the case is. I know it costs $5 million for just 30 seconds of airtime during the Super Bowl, but still, I feel like these Super Bowl commercials over the years have gotten worse and worse, to where now we're only getting 3, 4, maybe even 5 decent Super Bowl commercials, and the rest are kind of just, what was your takeaway?
Yeah, I have noticed that over the last several years. I can't say that I saw last year's Super Bowl, but this year was the first time I really tuned in to watch the commercials as much as the game. Because, you know, as you know, my interest in football has kind of waned over the last couple of years. And so I was just kind of watching the game for, you know, for the sake of watching it. But I really wanted to see what the commercials were going to be like. And, yeah, they were kind of underwhelming. You know, I saw, like, 3 or 4 Tide commercials, and that's really what I was thinking to myself too. I was like, man, these guys spent like $15 million on commercials this year, and you know, they were okay, I guess. But I guess that was what stood out the most, was that, you know, we saw the same companies paying over and over for this, you know, for the advertisement. But there was really nothing that really caught my interest. There was no movie commercials that were really interesting, or, you know, they were just meh, I guess, you know. So maybe it's just things are kind of changing. Maybe $5 million for a 30-second ad is not necessarily worth it for a lot of these companies, and they're not really finding it necessary to spend all that money for commercials during the Super Bowl. So I think with that, we're kind of seeing a decrease in the quality of these commercials.
I could certainly see that being the case because, like I said, $5 million for just 30 seconds, that's a lot of dough to chip over. Then you figure, okay, now we got to pay whatever, however many minutes our commercial is going to be, that's every 30 seconds, that's $5 million. Whatever celebrity we're going to bring in, okay, that's more money. The production, the filming, and then directing and all that goes into editing and all that. So, I mean, you look at it, you honestly could spend anywhere from $20 to $30 million on a commercial for the Super Bowl, and you got to wonder if it's really worth it. So it is what it is. You know, I know that was always one of the aspects that made the Super Bowl fun to watch is you got to see all the crazy and new commercials that they brought out there. But, hey, it is what it is. If nothing else, we did get a good game out of it. Can't say the same about that whack-ass halftime show, but that's what happens when you get Justin Timberlake. Yeah.
I find it funny as well that one of the big news things about, you know, like, or the memes that came out was Justin Timberlake taking selfies with the crowd, because I guess the show itself was very underwhelming. I didn't find much entertaining value throughout the halftime show, but I did find it funny that, you know, him taking selfies in the crowd was the biggest talking point after the Super Bowl.
No, certainly. I mean, that certainly was something that, as you saw it happening when he did go into the crowd, you started thinking, like, where is he going? Then when he kind of just stopped there, you figured, how many people are just going to lean in and try to catch a selfie with him? And sure enough, a kid did it. And Justin, you know, to much obliged to him, he kind of stood there for a few extra seconds and took it with him. So, but the kid himself didn't even look like he was into it. It looked like he was just on his phone, scrambling through, like, oh, wait, you're here. Let me get a selfie. Millennials, as they say, right?
Well, I think he was Googling who Justin Timberlake is, because at this point, he really knows.
Oh, that is true. That is true. The kid did look kind of young, and no disrespect to Justin, but, you know, his heyday was the late 90s and early and mid-2000s. So I would understand if a kid born in 2002 was maybe saying, who the hell is this guy? That's understandable. Speaking of who the hell is this guy, Leo, also what happened the day before the Super Bowl, we had a UFC fight night in Belém, Brazil, main event, Lyoto Machida. That's right, the Dragon. Ends a three fight losing skid, and edges out a split decision over Eric Anders. Pretty tough competition. Machida was split open on the forehead. These guys certainly showed that it was competitive, but Machida, being a savvy veteran, very unique and unorthodox style, pulled out the decision here. What did you make of Lyoto Machida? You know, he's been gone for a minute due to that suspension. Came back, didn't look so good in his last loss against Derek Brunson, but now gets in the win column. What did you make of the Dragon?
I'm happy for Lyoto Machida. I think, leading up to the fight, I was really hoping to see a revitalized Machida, and I really was hoping to see that in his last fight against Derek Brunson, but, you know, the fight wasn't even long enough to get a gauge of how Lyoto looked. And, man, it was just one of those typical Lyoto Machida fights where he's very elusive and he's just picking his spots left and right, but there's not a whole lot of action happening, and not really because of his opponent, because I think Eric Anders was really moving forward and looking to engage with Lyoto Machida. But Machida, you know, he's using that karate point style of fighting where he's playing it safe and he is picking spots, and he does have a few highlights here and there, but there's so little action in between those moments that it's kind of hard to get a gauge of who's winning the fight or what's really going on. So I could have really seen the fight go either way, and I'm not upset that Machida got the nod, but at the same time, it wasn't the most exciting fight. And I think this is what we were talking about last week, is that at this point, Lyoto Machida really needs a styles matchup in order to really get the fans excited about watching his fights. Because Eric Anders, as we said, he's a guy who's, you know, up and coming, and he's looking to get into title contention, but the stylistically, it just wasn't the right style of matchup, and that's where it kind of turned out into this semi-boring fight. I mean, I was mildly entertained watching it, but it wasn't exactly action-packed.
Yeah, that is one thing about Lyoto Machida's style, is it does make for a hard, enjoyable fight at times if he's not able to land some of his big shots, or if you're just not able to corner him and force him into fighting you with inside a phone booth, which credit to him. You know, I'm not saying, again, this isn't a let's rock 'em, sock 'em, you know, just bleed type fight. No, no, no. I enjoy a technical matchup just as much as the next fan, but there are times where the action is stalling and you kind of say, look, I'm not saying you guys got to throw, you know, 100 punches per round, but can you throw something? But, you know, kudos for Liotta. He was taking on the much younger, on a momentum, Eric Anders, a guy who, you know, was undefeated previously to this, had some pretty big, impressive wins throughout his short run in the UFC, and called him out after his victory in December. So Liotta was like, okay, well, I guess I'll take on this matchup. So kudos to him for getting that victory there. I want to ask you this. Interesting proposal, or at least a idea after the event, was now that Liotta's got this victory, probably not going to be in title contention anytime soon. You got Michael Bisping, the former middleweight champion, possibly on his way out with just one more fight. He's not going to be fighting UFC London, unfortunately, but one more fight could particularly be an interesting one for him to take. What do you think about the Count and the Dragon squaring off in the cage?
Yeah, this is absolutely the right call for Lyoto Machida. I'm so glad that he was actually, you know, within his mind to have a name in the back of his mind to call out. And I think Michael Bisping is the perfect guy. You know, as we've been saying, we need these legends to kind of face off against each other and not have the UFC match him up against the younger guys who are probably going to run through him. And, you know, luckily for Machida, this wasn't the case on Saturday. But I love the matchup between Liotta and Michael Bisping. I think this is probably a fight that could have happened several years ago, and it's kind of hard to believe that these guys haven't met each other before in their career. So I think this would be a perfect time to do it. Unfortunately, I think Michael Bisping has said that he's not going to be ready in time for the London card. So perhaps that retirement in his home country is not going to be happening this year. But if both Liotta and Michael Bisping are healthy down the line, maybe in the summer, then it would be a perfect time for them to match up. And, you know, as I said, they're both stand-up strikers and they're both guys that, you know, Michael Bisping more of a forward-moving type of fighter, but I think he would bring that out in Machida where there would be a lot more action in that fight as opposed to what we saw on Saturday. So I'd love to see that.
It definitely would be fun. Styles do make fights. And like you said, because Bisping is a forward type fighter, and Anders was pushing the pace too, but Bisping a little bit more technical with his kickboxing background, able to cut the ring off. And I certainly think because Bisping isn't known to have the one punch knockout power, don't ask Luke Rockhold that, unlike Eric Anders has, I think Machida would probably want to jump in the fire just a little bit more often than he did against the former Crimson Tide linebacker. I love the matchup in itself. You got two savvy veterans, two future Hall of Famers. You know, no disrespect, but they're on the last leg of their career. I mean, Bisping, what, is going to retire after this, more than likely. So it would make sense to get these two future Hall of Famers to get in the cage against one another. There's really not another matchup that makes a lot of sense for either one of them, especially given that Michael Bisping doesn't want to fight someone like a Vitor Belfort. We know what's going on with a certain former middleweight champion right now that we'll get into later in the show. So I really do feel that this particular matchup does make a lot of sense. The Michael Bisping versus Rashad Evans fight I was hearing, I mean, what did you think about that? Like, what excites you more? Bisping taking on Evans in a rematch from their fight in 07, or Bisping and Machida facing each other for the first time? Which one excites you more? Because I kind of feel like the Evans one kind of fell on deaf ears, like, really? That? I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I'd certainly like to see the fresher matchup between Liotta and Bisping, and I think Rashad Evans, man, he's been a sort of an enigma for the last several fights in his career. And even when, you know, when he first decided to move down the middleweight, we thought, you know, maybe this will be the right move in his career. Maybe he's going to revitalize and, you know, pump some new life into his career. But even then, you know, he's turned on some pretty lackluster performances against, you know, middle of the pack journeyman type fighters. So I think Rashad Evans he should be anyway a lot closer to retirement than Michael Bisping. And we know that Michael is probably looking to fight once more, but Michael Bisping anyway looks like the much more active fighter. And I think Rashad has just kind of fallen off, you know, in a hard way. And I really don't know why he is, you know, talking about continuing his career. I mean, I understand that there's probably still money out there for him, but I just don't see much interest in the career of Rashad Evans at this point, unless he does fight those legendary type of fights. But even then, I just don't see him being very competitive in them. But as far as Lyoto Machida, he is sort of in the same boat, but I mean, we can still see that he's still able to get those victories at the high levels in the UFC. So I would like to see Machida over a guy like Rashad Evans.
Yeah, certainly. I just didn't feel excited when I heard that Bisping and Evans was being negotiated. Evans is another one that I feel like his fighting style isn't really exciting. If you just took away one head kick and one overhand right, his career isn't like, don't get me wrong, he is a former champion and he's fought and beaten some of the best in the sport. Yes, but outside of those two highlights, the head kick knockout and overhand right that he landed on Chuck Liddell, how many highlights are you really looking at from this guy? How many fights are you going back and saying, oh man, you got to watch this Rashad Evans fight? So, I just wasn't really thrilled with that, but I am intrigued by Lyoto Machida and Michael Bisping. I feel that because they're both chess players, you really have to figure out their styles, and they're not easy people to defeat. Even though Bisping has been finished before, against Rockhold, GSP, Vitor. If you look at it, he's only lost to like the really top elite guys, or in Bisping's case, guys who stick needles in their ass. So I definitely would like to see these two go at it. I think it'd be a perfect matchup between the two savvy veterans, and they'll be equally matched up against one another. Speaking of evenly matched up against each other, Leo, one of the sad showings this past Saturday was a brutal mismatch in the co-main event of the women's flyweight division. We have Valentina Shevchenko making her UFC flyweight debut. Flyweight is 125 pounds against UFC newcomer Priscilla Cochiera. Now, Priscilla, outside the UFC, she's a very accomplished fighter. She's been in some good fights. Obviously, though, when you step into the UFC, just like any major professional sporting league, it's another level, and you are taking on tougher competition. And for her to take on one of the most established strikers in the women's divisions, regardless of weight class, in Valentina Shevchenko, it clearly was a total mismatch, and that it was. Shevchenko outlanded her, I believe, 273-3. Let me just say that again. 273-3 was the differential in strikes landing in this particular fight. UFC referee Mario Yamasaki, heavily criticized by not only Dana White, but many fans and critics alike for not stopping this fight much, much sooner. What did you make of this one-sided ass whooping that Valentina gave to Priscilla, who, hats off to her for showing great heart and determination not to give in so easily?
Yeah, I think kudos to Valentina Shevchenko as well, because as soon as the 125-pound division was inaugurated, everybody was calling for Valentina Shevchenko to basically lay claim to the championship at that weight class. And, you know, she didn't go through the Ultimate Fighter, so therefore someone else was crowned champion. But at this point, I think Valentina, especially after this Saturday, she does lay claim to being the uncrowned champion at that weight class, and she was so dominant. And it was interesting because she was dominant on the feet, and she was the one who decided to take the fight down twice in both rounds. And it was all, you know, downhill from there for Priscilla Cachoeira. And I really can't blame the matchmaking. I mean, it is a brand new division, and these things are going to happen because there really is no sense of rankings in these new divisions. So unfortunately, you do have to see these mismatches. And unfortunately for Priscilla, it happened this past Saturday. But man, to have Mario Yamasaki just watch as she takes over 200 punches, unanswered punches at that. And it was just a brutal, brutal thing to watch. And unfortunately for Priscilla, Mario just didn't do anything to stop it. And Valentina basically had to, you know, take the submission victory after, you know, as you said, 200 plus unanswered punches. So and at the same time, Priscilla's corner, they really didn't do anything to stop the massacre, because you know, after the first round, I think it was pretty clear that it was a one-sided match. So they let her go out there for the second round, and even in the second round, she was in crucifix position for several minutes, and they didn't throw in the towel, they didn't do anything. So there's a lot of blame to throw out there, but it is unfortunate that Mario Yamasaki just keeps finding himself in these situations over and over and over again, where he just steps in way too late, or in this case, he didn't step in at all.
Yeah, you know, many people gave Steve Mazzagatti the label of worst referee in MMA, and he rightfully deserved it, that damn prick. But Mario Yamasaki, you know, and what's weird is Yamasaki, unlike some referees, not all, but some, he has a legit black belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. He's been around for a while. I don't know what it is. I don't know if maybe, you know, just with so many miles on there, if he's just not responding the same way, if maybe he needs a break to recharge the battery. I'm not sure, but as you said, he finds himself in these positions time and time again, and part of the referee's job is to protect the fighters in there. We often say, we often say that the referees need to let the fights go a little bit longer, and I've been in favor of that at times as well. But that's when a fighter is out there showing that they're fighting back, not when they're taking 200 unanswered strikes. That in itself should tell you it's over, man. So it's very unfortunate what happened. Priscilla did suffer a torn ACL, so she's most likely out for, if not the rest of the year, a big chunk of the year. So she won't even have a chance to really earn significant earnings with the promotion later on throughout this year to get back. So shout out to her, speedy recovery. And I want to ask you this. Who is more at fault here? The UFC for putting on such a mismatched fight? Mario Yamasaki for not stepping in sooner, given that he is the third person in the cage? Or the fighter's corner, who, as you said, after the first round, clearly saw that their fighter was mismatched and allowed her to be in a crucifix position, which, if people don't realize, that's when you're laying on your back, an opponent is basically laying on your chest, holding your one arm with their legs and your other arm with one hand, and they basically have a free hand to rain elbows or strikes down on you. Who's more at fault here for not stopping the fight sooner? The corner, the referee, or the promotion for putting on such a mismatched fight?
Yeah, as I said, there is no shortage of blame to go around, but I kind of find it hard to believe that the UFC really has much fault in it, because, as I said, the division is brand new, and it's hard to get a sense of how these women are ranked, because, you know, as we recall, when the 115-pound division was brand new, there really wasn't much of a sense for who Joanna Jędrzejczyk was. And then she goes in, you know, in her first title fight against Carla Esparza, and she demolishes her. And, you know, all of a sudden, this unknown fighter becomes the new champion of the division, and she became a very dominant champion for several years. And I think that's just the same that's going on in the brand new 125-pound division, is that, you know, there's all these names out there, and, you know, Priscilla Cachoeira was 8-0, so there's really no sense to see that, you know, she might get demolished by Valentina Shevchenko. I think everybody knows who Valentina is, but, you know, the lack of knowledge, you know, for the rest of the names in the division, it does make it hard to get these matches up to par, you know, and have them be, you know, competitive up to UFC standards. So certainly, I think Mario Yamasaki deserves the bulk of the blame, because he was the man in the octagon, and he's the guy who's in there, whose job it is to protect the fighters when things go awry. And certainly he didn't do anything for, you know, 9.5 minutes of how long the fight started. So but at the same time, Priscilla's corner, they could have certainly done something to stop the massacre, because it was just egregious, you know, how much punishment she took. So certainly blame falls in between her corner, and more of the blame falls on Yamasaki.
Yeah, I mean, the referee is definitely in there to be a safe haven, to not only control the fight, but to protect the fighters. But also, you know, the corner has to take a lot of responsibility in this as well, because they clearly know the skill level of their fighter. You have all the confidence in the world in your fighter, but you also have to watch out for their own safety. Most of the time, they're not going to tap out themselves unless they're forced to. So you have to make sure that you're the one in there. Look, this isn't Rocky IV where you don't throw in the damn towel and let them go out on their shield, okay? You can't do rewrites here. So the corner definitely deserves some blame here. I think the UFC deserves some blame, but I do agree with you. Because the division is new, trying to find quality opponents will be difficult. So, you know, we saw that with Cyborg when she first came over to the UFC. No disrespect to Leslie Smith and her other opponent, but, you know, you're not going to get the cream of the crop for newcomers trying to build out a new division just yet. So we'll see how the rest of the women's flyweight division goes from there as it continues to go on. But Valentina Shevchenko did put on a tremendous showing, and most likely because of her record going into this and then her showing here, probably is going to get the next title shot later on this year, which would be an interesting matchup.
Yeah, I think at this point she absolutely has earned a title shot against Nico Montano. I think Nico has said that she is recovering from an injury, so I don't know the timeline for her return, but at this point, Valentina is undeniably the number one contender at that brand new division. As far as you know, the UFC's blame in this horrible mismatch, I think one thing that we can certainly point out is that this pay structure that the UFC has is really flawed, and it shows you know, why maybe the corner of Pacilla was apprehensive in calling the fight is because, so in the UFC we have you're basically half of your money for showing up and fighting, and then the other half is if you win. So if you lose, then you don't get that other half of your purse. Now that's when it starts to get a little bit iffy, when, you know, we decide to throw in the towel if, you know, I'm costing my fighter half their money, and then I can see why the corner would be really apprehensive for you know, letting the fight go at that point, even though they're not really doing their job in protecting the fighter. But I think that just shows the flaw in that system. I think the UFC should, at this point, you know, they're the biggest league in the world as far as MMA. They should really get rid of that system and just pay the fighters a flat amount. You know, whether win, lose, or draw, they get the same amount of money. And that, you know, that way, not only do we probably get more exciting fights, because, you know, people are not going to be point fighting as much, but I think that the corners are going to be a lot more conscious about stepping in and protecting the fighters.
I don't know if we're going to get more exciting fights. You look over at Bellator, and where, you know, when you got Boy McDonald over there and Ryan the Go-To Sleeper fighting over there, you're not necessarily getting the most thrilling fights over there. But I do get what you're saying. But you know what? But look at the corner, though. She wasn't going to win whatsoever, and now because of the injury, she's even out longer. So now the money you, quote-unquote, didn't allow her to win, she wouldn't even be able to make that up probably for the rest of 2018. So now you don't shot yourself in both feet. So I get what you're saying, but at the same time, when it's that much of a lopsided victory, look, this isn't Chael Sonnen Anderson Silva, where Silva, you know, was taking a lot of punishment, but it wasn't like damaging punishment. I mean, he took over 200 strikes. He didn't even look like he went through a warm-up session with Chael Sonnen. So it's totally different as opposed to that, and then the beat Darren Shevchenko was giving her. So I just think the corners, more often than not, need to take more responsibility for watching their fighters. And real quickly before we move on, it kind of looks at what people criticized David Branch for in his last fight against Luke Rockhold. Luke Rockhold took his back. We all know how dangerous Luke Rockhold is on the in top position on the ground. He had him he had him laid out flat. He was raining down punches from his back. Branch tried to get out, tried to move, couldn't do it. Instead of taking more punches and going out on his shield and taking a punishment, he tapped out due to strike, and he was ready to turn around on a quicker basis than most fighters. So I also think, hey, some fighters maybe need to take some responsibility and just say, look, man, if I'm in a position where I'm just getting my butt kicked and I'm so overmatched, because I truly believe fighters know when they're overmatched. When you take on Steph Curry and he's lighting it up from three-point land, you know, oh, damn, this is one of those nights where no matter what I do, he's going to be on like fire. So I got to figure out a different way to come out here and do something, because me guarding him isn't going to stop him. And same thing with fighters. I think when you're in there, there's certain matches where you just know I'm overmatched. Unless I throw a Hail Mary, which we don't see, I'm done. I definitely think they need to take some more wisdom from that and say maybe, just maybe, there's times where maybe I should tap out myself, save myself not only the injuries but also taking so much damage, because you might be able to turn around sooner than you think. Now, that was what we just saw. let's look at what we're about to see. This coming weekend, we have UFC 221 taking place. Man, oh, man, did this card get a lot of changes happening to it. It's going to be in Perth, Australia. First time that the UFC has been in Perth. And originally on the card was Australia's native Robert Whittaker. He was supposed to be scheduled to fight here in the main event with the interim middleweight title. Initially, the thought was maybe against George St. Pierre to unify the titles, but as we all know, George St. Pierre fighting again at middleweight after the Bisping fight was highly unlikely, but he did also suffer an injury. So GSP vacates the middleweight title. Robert Whittaker becomes the unified middleweight champion, and he was going to face former UFC middleweight champion Luke Rockhold, who, as I just said, came off a victory over David Branch in September in Pittsburgh. Unfortunately, Robert Whittaker suffers an injury, but also he had – I'm trying to look it up here to get exact, but from what I understand, he had a
– staph.
There you go. He had staph, but I believe it was on his intestines, was it, Leo? Do you know?
I think so. It was either his intestine or his stomach, but it was internal staph infection that he suffered.
Yeah, thank you. He had an internal staph infection, so he had to be pulled from that. Thankfully, he is going to make a full recovery from that. That's a scary thing to deal with. But replacing him is the man that Whittaker beat to become the interim middleweight champion, Yoel Romero. Thank Jesus! So now we are going to get Cuba versus USA. Yoel Romero versus Luke Rockhold for the UFC interim middleweight championship. What do you make of all this roller coaster of the main event going on? What do you make of Romero versus Rockhold?
Yeah, this is one of those rare cases where, I mean, I was really looking forward to the Robert Whittaker and Luke Rockhold fight. And I think Whittaker really became a revelation last year when, you know, after beating Jacare Souza and then what he did to Yoel Romero. But unfortunately, he had to withdraw from the fight. But at the same time, this is one of those rare cases where the alternate fight is just as exciting, if not even more exciting, because now it's Yoel Romero against Luke Rockhold. And I can't really complain about that fight. I think that's a wonderful fight, and it's a fight that we probably would have gotten anyway if Romero would have just held on just a little bit longer against Robert Whittaker in that fight, because I think Yoel was pretty much on his way to victory, if not for that final takedown in the last few seconds of the fifth round. So this is probably a fight that we would be seeing anyway with Romero as the champion. So I can't really complain about the alternate matchup. Unfortunately, the rest of the card is not exactly stacked, and it's not very exciting, but it is one of those pay-per-views where the main event is reason enough to tune in, because this is going to be a very exciting matchup and a very competitive one.
No, very, very much so. Yoel Romero, Luke Rockhold, obviously wasn't the main event we all thought we was going to get, but on short notice, it's actually a pretty good replacement. I wish, you know, once again, I wish there would have been a little bit more time to prepare for this matchup, especially for someone like Yoel Romero, who's, if I believe, he's either 39 or he's 40 now. He's actually 40 years old. You know, he's 40 years old, even though he last fought in, I believe it was June or July when him and Whittaker went at it. Even though he last fought then, you figure 40 years old, 4 weeks notice to prepare for a fight against, honestly, one of the best middleweights in the world, and Luke Rockhold. That's a lot to overcome, especially for someone with his physique. You just got to wonder how much cardio might come into play for the Cuban native here. But with all that aside, we do got Luke Rockhold, 6'3", a lefty, one of the most lethal and dangerous left kicks we have in mixed martial arts. He stands at 16-3, 10 wins by submissions, one of the best on the ground from the top position, a very good and fluid striker, throws a lot of left kicks, but even though you know it's coming, it is deadly. And he throws a nice little change-up kick where it looks like it's going low, then he flips it to come up high, and he's landing some good strikes with that one, as Michael Bisping. So I definitely am intrigued by this, because Rockhold, you would think, would want to keep this standing because of his striking, his athletic ability, and his power. Yoel Romero, who is one of the most accomplished wrestlers in the world, a silver medalist in the 2000 Olympics, you know, for all his wrestling pedigree, most of his victories have come by knocking guys out. And he's fought a who's who as far as Chris Weidman, Derek Brunson, Lyoto Machida, Jacare. But, you know, he stands at 6 foot. So you figure not only the age, but the size difference that Rocco could have over Romero height-wise, that could be a big factor. And maybe Rockhold wanted to hold him up against the cage, lean on him, wear his body on him, try to gas that cardio tank out. But, you know, Romero, 12-2, 10 wins by knockout. This is a guy who's very explosive, very dangerous knee, very stiff left hand. So this is going to be an intriguing matchup on what will Romero like to do. Would he like to stand and pick his shots and kind of, you know, conserve his energy? Would he like to maybe rush Luke Rockhold and put him on his back and control him from there? Will Rockhold try to keep it standing? Or Rockhold maybe do what Weidman did and said, hey, I'm so good on the ground, I'm actually going to test myself against Joe Romero and to see if I can take him down and what I can do from the top game. So it's a very intriguing matchup between the two. Who would you say the winner obviously is going to get the interim middleweight title, but who would you say needs this victory more? Romero at 40 years old or Rockhold to kind of show that he's still amongst the elite at the middleweight division and his loss to Bisping was really just an oversight on his part?
Yeah, I think you have to favor – this is a lot bigger of a matchup for Luke Rockhold at this point because he is a former champion, and we thought for, you know, for the year or less that he was champion that he was going to be this unbeatable guy until he ran into Michael Bisping, you know, who stepped in on short notice and knocked out Luke Rockhold. And you know, he really hasn't been able to reclaim, you know, a stake for being the number one contender up until recently. And he is only coming off one victory. But I think it is a much bigger matchup for Luke Rockhold. I think he does want to reclaim that title. And he does want to, you know, basically make that claim that the Michael Bisping loss was a fluke, as he's been claiming for, you know, for the last year. So it is a much bigger one for Luke Rockhold. And I do want to see that contrast between, you know, Luke Rockhold, as you said, his top jiu-jitsu game is absolutely phenomenal. He's got one of the best mounts in the middleweight division. And I do want to see, you know, if the fight ends up on the ground and if Luke Rockhold can manage to get on mount, how is Romero going to respond to that? Because he does have probably the best wrestling in the division. So I want to see how that grappling exchange turns out. And as you mentioned as well, Yoel Romero, he does have somewhat of a history with bad cardio issues. So I do want to see how he responds to that. He was preparing for a fight against David Branch in Orlando, you know, a few weeks earlier, but now it's going to be a 5-round fight. So I want to see if Luke Rockhold does want to take it into deep waters and want to see if test that theory against Romero that he does have bad cardio issues. Although Romero has shown that even when he is tired, he's still dangerous and he can still knock people out. So I wouldn't really count out Romero at any point during the fight. But as far as who this is bigger for, it's certainly for Rockhold. I think he does want to reclaim that championship and prove that the loss to Michael Bisping was just a one-time incident and that he is that dominant champion that people were expecting him to be.
Yeah, see, I actually think it's bigger for Romero because he's 40 years old and this would be his second straight loss. And, you know, in this very, very tough middleweight division, I really do think two losses in a row against two of the best, you know, Whitaker and now Luke Rockhold, would really put Romero far down the ladder as far as competition. Now, granted, because he's such a dominant fighter and because he has accomplished so much, if he continues to fight, another win or two could certainly put him back up there, but it'll just be that much tougher. For Rockhold, I think, yeah, he does need a victory to show that his loss against Michael Bisping in his first title defense was more so of an oversight for him, overlooking Michael Bisping, who he previously beat before. But I do feel that Rockhold has more options for his career if things don't work out here. He can still move up to light heavyweight. Hell, there's even been talk about him taking on Fabrizio Verdum at heavyweight. So I do believe that Rockhold, if he suffered a loss here, wouldn't be as bad for his career projecting towards the future as it would be for Romero. As you got to imagine, at 40 years old, you know, what, 20-plus years in combative sports, how much more gas does he have left in the tank to go out there and compete at such a high level? That remains to be seen. But nonetheless, yeah, I think we're still going to get a good main event between these two top flight middleweights here.
Yeah, I think the fact that Yoel Romero is 40 years old is precisely why I don't think that this is, you know, win or die for him, because you know, we haven't seen him look old besides the documented cardio issues that we've seen him. We haven't really seen an old looking Romero, but at 40 years old, that's due to happen any time now. And this is a crazy sport where, you know, one fight you look fantastic, and then the very next fight you're already looking like a 40-year-old fighter. So that's precisely why I don't necessarily put too much stock into one fight for Yoel Romero, because it could be like an Anderson Silva type situation where 1 minute you're champion, the next minute you're getting knocked out. So I just want to see Rockhold, because he is a younger fighter and he does have a much longer career ahead of him, that it is a bigger deal for him to reclaim, you know, basically the number one contender spot. Whereas Romero, it doesn't really matter if he loses this one, he could still be in a lot of fun fights for the rest of his career and he'll be just fine.
See, I think with Romero, because of his age, he's going to need this quicker, just because, you know, like I said, how much more does he have left? And given his size at 6 foot, granted, he could probably still make it, but I don't know if he can make the jump up to 205 and be as successful. He possibly could, but you figure someone like Rockhold, he's got opportunities for days. People don't realize Luke Rockhold's a big, big guy. He is 6'3". He cut a lot of weight to make 185. He always makes it, so no worries there. But nonetheless, I think we're going to get a tremendous matchup here. You know, and again, not just for the cardio sake of Romero on short notice, but also just for the quality of matchup. I really would have liked if we would have just a few more weeks or a proper training camp for this, because I really do think this is one of the best matchups in the middleweight division. If you just look at the top talent there and you say, well, let's match some guys up, I think this is one of the best ones, especially styles make fights. These are two very good styles to match up against each other. So it's going to be fun to see how these two do in the cage toe-to-toe. Speaking of fun, the co-main event, Mark Hunt taking on Curtis Blaydes. How do you say it?
Yeah, Blaydes.
Okay, I was going to say, why I feel like I'm not saying it correctly. But this should be an interesting matchup, given the fact, you know, Hunt had his very public feud with the UFC, and he even talked about once he fights out his last, I believe, two fights in the UFC, you know, he's going to leave the promotion and be done with it. So he wants to try to, you know, cash out whatever he's got. But we're talking about one of the hardest hitters known to man in Mark Hunt. And at 43 years old, you know, age is up there, but he's kind of shown that he's not really slowing down all that much. But he's taking on Curtis Blaydes, a very good top 10 heavyweight. He's ranked number 9, tremendous wrestling background, very good power, and somebody who you start looking at and saying, you know what, this guy's pretty tough. For people that don't know, he took Francis Ngannou the distance before Stipe Miocic. Granted, it was in a losing effort, and he did get his eye popped, but he did give Ngannou a pretty good showdown when they first met each other. What do you think of this matchup, Hunt versus Blaydes?
Yeah, I'm more interested in the background than the fight itself. I think, as you said, Mark Hunt is one of the biggest hitters in the division, and he hasn't slowed down. The power is the last thing to go, and I think he still has the technical acumen and the power to put away Curtis Blaydes. But I am more interested in what the background of the story is, because as you said, Mark Hunt does have that public feud with the UFC going on, and last time the UFC was in Australia, Mark Hunt was scheduled to fight, and then they had to pull him out because Mark Hunt was talking about basically things that are very sensitive in terms of, you know, when people talk about things like, what do you call it, like CTE and brain damage, where he said he was losing memory and you know, he was forgetting things and not coordinating properly, and so the UFC was forced to withdraw him, and there was a big stink made about that. So, you know, now, you know, it's just a few months later, now the UFC is willing to put Mark Hunt in another fight. So I am more interested in seeing what's going to come out of that. And if he does say that, you know, he wants to fight out his contract and be done with it, I am wondering if somewhere like Bellator would be a good fit for him, because it doesn't sound like he's necessarily wanting to retire. He just doesn't want to keep fighting for the UFC because he feels like they've done him wrong on so many levels. So I am very much interested in seeing what the saga of Mark Hunt outside the octagon is going to bring after the next couple of fights.
Now, certainly, I mean, you know, for Mark Hunt, you know, I can understand where he's coming from. He has fought some fighters in the past who have been known or at least popped off for drugs. You know, Bigfoot Silva was one of them. Brock Lesnar was another of them. And kind of feels like, look, man, if you got me in here, especially the one against Bigfoot Silva, you know, you got me in here taking on these guys. I'm taking all these shots to the head. And, you know, now my memory's starting to go. I'm slurring a little bit. And you guys aren't compensating me correctly when I'm taking on known cheaters. This isn't the Wild Wild West, or this isn't back in the days where, you know, we really didn't test guys for this stuff all the time. Now with USADA here and these guys are still trying to cheat, you should compensate your fighters for it. And you know what? I honestly agree with that. You know, if a fighter, if you guys fight and you do pop out for PEDs, look, we can have a debate whether PEDs should be allowed or not in the sport, but be that as it may, right now they're not. If you pop out for that, your opponent, win or lose, should get some extra compensation. So I'm totally with Mark Hunt on that one. He did shoot himself in the foot, though, giving an interview before a fight saying that he was losing his memory. Was hard for him to remember things. He is slurring his words a bit. You can't say that kind of stuff if you're in combat sports. You just can't do that, Mark Hunt. So I think there, you know, he kind of shot himself in the foot. But, you know, as you said, and I pointed out earlier, at 43 years old, doesn't look like he's slowing down, and someone who still talks about wanting to compete. Will that be in Bellator? They could certainly use some heavyweights over there. Will that be in Ryzen or another promotion? We shall see. But Mark Hunt is a fighter's fighter. He's a fan favorite. His knockout punch is something to just marvel at. And, you know, I think this is a good fight because you got Mark Hunt, who we know can end your life with one strike, and he's a savvy veteran and a fan favorite. You got Curtis Blaydes, who's an up-and-comer, but a very intriguing prospect. 26 years old, he's 8-1-1. His one no contest was overturned after a victory when he tested hot for marijuana, which, honestly, come on, should that still be on the ban list? But he's a very intriguing prospect with very good power. So I'm very interested to see how this is. And Leo, I know me and you maybe sometimes have split hairs on veterans taking on young up-and-comers. I don't feel this is beating a young guy or an old guy to the wolves here. I feel that this is a pretty decent matchup because Mark Hunt is still a valuable heavyweight. He got a victory this past summer over Derek Lewis, and Curtis Blaydes has shown, hey, he's certainly somebody to look out for coming up. So I don't feel this is, well, Mark Hunt is on the last leg, let's feed him to an up-and-coming prospect we don't want to promote. And I don't feel that, well, Curtis is a prospect we kind of like, let's just throw him out there so he can get knocked out by Hunt. I think it's a pretty fair matchup. What do you think?
No, I absolutely agree. I think the heavyweight division is just a completely different animal. You know, it's not, you know, these guys aren't cutting weight. They don't look or they don't seem as old as some of these, you know, other fighters in their late 30s or early 40s. And let's say that the middleweight division or below, right, where these guys have been cutting weight for so many years in their careers that, you know, they just can't seem to be doing that to their bodies any longer. So I think it is different in the heavyweight division. You know, Mark Hunt, he is somewhat of a journeyman fighter where he has, you know, as many wins as he has losses in his career. But as you say, he's not a guy who's slowing down. He's not necessarily going out there and you know, getting brutally knocked out or just looking old in these fights. You know, he's still looking very competitive, and he does seem to have a, you know, one track mind when he's in fights. You know, he's always looking to spam his big right hand and try to knock the other guy out, but more often than not, it works. So I don't necessarily see it as a mismatch of any sort. Even though, as you say, Curtis Blaydes is the much younger guy and he is the up and coming guy, and it probably is true that the UFC might be looking to build Curtis Blaydes off the name of Mark Hunt, but I just don't see Mark Hunt as a victim in this case, right? Where I think Mark Hunt is more than capable, and in fact, I favor him over Curtis Blaydes. So I don't really see any problem with the matchmaking, especially because the UFC heavyweight division is so thin that at some point you just have to match these guys up no matter what. Whereas, you know, other divisions are much more stacked, where if you can avoid it, then you probably should avoid, you know, these styles of matchups where, you know, the young up and coming lion is probably going to tear through the older guy. But in the heavyweight division, I think it's just, it's a different story, so I'm much more accepting of that in this case.
Now, speaking of much more accepting, one of the things we have to accept, and it's very unfortunate, is we may not be able to see this matchup take place for the second time now. A matchup between Max Holloway defending his featherweight title against Frankie Edgar has been postponed, this time due to the Hawaiian being injured. Holloway suffered a leg injury in training. He's been pulled from the UFC 222 card against Frank Yeager. It's very, very unfortunate. Speedy recovery for Max Holloway, just like Frank Yeager with his injury that he suffered. So one day, maybe, we'll see this matchup happen. But, Leo, a matchup we might see happen. And I don't know. But according to rumors and according to reports, the Stockton bad boy himself, Mr. 209, Nate Diaz, 100% want in on UFC 222. Does this mean he'll cut the extra 10 pounds and fight Frankie Edgar at 145? Does Frankie move up to 55 and fight Nate Diaz? I don't know. Nate Diaz compared to Frankie Edgar is going to look like Shaq taking on Monkey Bogues, but be that as it may, what do you make of, one, the unfortunate news of Holloway having to pull out and this fight being postponed again, and two, the possibility that Nate Diaz might get put on the card to try to save it?
Yeah, I'm absolutely devastated about Max Holloway. I was really looking forward to this fight, and unfortunately for the second time, we don't get to see it again. So I really don't know what the UFC is going to do with Frankie Edgar. I don't really see them matching Frankie against Nate Diaz. It just doesn't really make sense, because if Frankie loses, then maybe that might get in the way of his title contention. And what do you do with Nate Diaz at that point? He's not going to contend at 145. And then if Frankie wins, then you just kind of diminish the name value of Nate Diaz. So I think Nate is 100% on board with trying to rescue the main event, but I don't know that he's 100% down to just fight whoever the UFC wants, because you know the big name out there for Nate Diaz has been Eddie Alvarez, and there's some reports out there that say that Nate doesn't want any part of that fight. So so I don't know what Nate's commitment is to stepping in on late notice and taking any fight, or you know, or if he's really wanting to step in, or if he's just talking to get his name out there on the news cycle. But at this point, man, look at UFC 222. Besides Max Holloway and Frankie Edgar, there really wasn't much of interest on that card. And now that the fight is off the main event, then there's not much going on for UFC 222. So I think the UFC might want to start thinking about either canceling the pay-per-view or putting it on free cable TV, because that's what you get when you have so many shows throughout the year that you don't have enough fighters to fill out these cards. When the big one falls out, then that's what you get. It's just a very mediocre card that is going to do absolutely nothing on pay-per-view. So if they really can't, you know, come to terms with Nate Diaz, then I think we might have to see a cancellation at UFC 222.
It is very unfortunate. I don't know if they would cancel it just from this aspect. They do have, I agree with you. They should take it off pay-per-view if they can't find a suitable big name to put in the main event here. And UFC 222, for those, it happens March 3rd, so less than a month, right out here in T-Mobile Arena. Oh, man. Leo, good news for us is those tickets might be really cheap. Hey, I'm just saying.
They might be giving them away along with the free interim titles.
Exactly. Oh, wait, I forgot. That's what WWE does for their shows. My bad. But they do have a heavyweight clash of Stefan Struve versus Andre Arlovski. They got Hector Lombard, Stipe Dalloway. They got the UFC debut of Mackenzie Dern. Castagano finally coming back. Sean O'Malley is going to be on the card as well. So I do agree with you that, yeah, this is not a pay-per-view card unless they could really pull something out the hat here. Maybe putting it back on Fox Sports 1 or Fox itself, that can save it. But, man, it's a very tough, tough blow for the main event itself. But Nate Diaz, yeah, he wants back, and it is weird that he wants back, but he doesn't want to fight Eddie Alvarez, though. And it's almost like, well, look, he's a big name. He just came off the big-time victory over Justin Gaethje. Outside of him being a champion, he's not going to get that much hotter. So why not strike while the iron is hot here? I know a fight maybe with Kevin Lee will be very intriguing, but that's not on the table just yet. So, yeah, for Nate Diaz, is he just trolling here, or is he serious about coming back? That remains to be seen. But if he is serious about wanting to be on the 220 card, 222 card, that would be pretty insane to think that he's stepping up on late notice once again. But who would it be against? Would it be Frankie Edgar, or would it be somebody else? Interesting. Plus, I'm also hearing that Brian Ortega might step up and take on Frankie Edgar on short notice as well. Still, everything has to be ironed out because, like you said, for Edgar, it really doesn't make a lot of sense. Unless Holloway is going to be out for an extended period of time and an interim title is on the line, doesn't make a lot of sense for him to take another fight and risk in his number one contender title shot just yet. So we'll see how this card unfolds in the coming days.
Yeah, so here's what I know about the Brian Ortega situation is that I think they do want to make that fight. They don't want to do it for an interim championship, but there is some kind of negotiation going on with Brian Ortega because I believe he's on the last fight of his contract. And they want to re-sign him before they put him in another fight. So I think there is that contract negotiation. And as far as I know, they're pretty close to coming to terms. So they might do Frankie and Brian Ortega for a non-title fight. And, man, if they really want to keep this on pay-per-view, then Nate Diaz is the perfect guy. You know, if you don't have any champions to defend the title, Nate Diaz is the only guy who's not a champion who's going to sell pay-per-views. And I think it's a big misstep by Nate to not want to fight Eddie Alvarez because Eddie Alvarez has said that, that he is basically keeping himself ready in case Tony Ferguson or Khabib Nurmagomedov falls through. So if he's staying ready and if Nate Diaz is, quote-unquote, 100% willing to step in, then this is the perfect matchup, right? As you said, he's a former champion, Eddie Alvarez is, and he's coming off a very big victory. And they, had that back and forth that they had in Mexico City a few years ago. I think it's absolutely perfect. The stars are aligned, but I don't know if Nate is just looking for more money or, as you said, maybe he's just trolling and trying to keep his name on the news. But if he's 100% willing to step in, then he should be 100% willing to face Eddie Alvarez because that's absolutely perfect. But I guess we'll see what happens, man. And I mean, not only that, if Nate Diaz does step in on last minute, then he's coming to the rescue of the UFC, which is something that they love, right? So it would be harder for the UFC to deny Nate whatever it is that he wants in the future. So if Nate wants to do himself any favors, then I think he should take the fight on late notice, as he said he's willing to do.
Ain't gonna be that damn hard. I still told him, Nate, don't get too big for your britches now, okay? You bailed us out. But don't think you're going to come in here calling the damn shots because either one, you either get in the fight that you want or because you're not getting no $20, $25 million. I can tell you that right then. In fact, you probably won't even get double digits in millions of dollars unless y'all break crazy numbers in pay-per-view. So, again, we'll see how it all works out here for the UFC in this particular one. One matchup that has been proposed is, what about a bantamweight throwdown between TJ Dillashaw putting his belt on the line against Cody Garbrandt? Cody has accepted it, called him out, obviously, as we know he would. But TJ Dillashaw said, no, he's actually not going to step up to take on Cody for a number of reasons. One, after he lost a very close decision to Dominick Cruz, it took him 2 years and a stint on the Ultimate Fighter opposite Cody Garbrandt to finally work his way back to a title shot. And this is coming off of knocking out Cody Garbrandt in the second round of their fight in November. Cody has not defended the title one successful time like TJ did. And, even though he did wobble him at the end, still, I knocked you out and finished you. Plus, it is on 4 weeks' notice, and he did just have a new addition to his family and a baby boy. So, hey, I just had my family, the holidays, 4 weeks' notice. Come on, man. That's not fair for everything that I had to go through and everything that I got to go through to get in fight shape. Plus, I'm kind of focused on a bigger fight with a guy named Demetrius Johnson at 125. What do you make of the potential of a rematch between these two on short notice? And who do you side with? Cody for saying, hey, step up and give me my rematch? Or TJ for saying, slow your roll, partner. You got to earn it.
No, I agree 1,000,000% with everything that TJ Dillashaw said because he did lose a very, very close split decision fight against Dominick Cruz, which a lot of people thought that TJ won. I'm not on that side of it. But, man, like everything that TJ had to go through just to get back into title contention, and now all of a sudden, Cody Garbrandt wants to step in, after coming off a loss from a belt that he never successfully defended, and now he wants to, step in on short notice and challenge for the title? I don't think so. I think CJ has 100% right to decline that fight. Obviously, it's not good for the UFC, but it is good for TJ and his career. And just as TJ is holding out hope for that Demetrius Johnson fight, I'm looking forward to that as well. So I wouldn't want to see that fight be scrapped in order for TJ to defend his title against Cody Garbrandt, you know, which is a fight that we've already seen. And I think, you know, I got a little bit tired of the back and forth, mostly on Cody Garbrandt's side. You know, that whole high school drama thing that they had going on, you know, it wore a little bit thin with me after several weeks of watching that. So I don't necessarily want to see that anytime soon. And I do want to see the Demetrius Johnson and TJ Dillashaw fight. I think that's the best super fight that the UFC can make at this point, and I don't want to see that be taken away just for a rematch, just because you need to hold the plug on short notice. So I'm in agreement with TJ Dillashaw. I think Cody Garbrandt should fight his way back up to the belt, even if it's one fight. That's not too much to ask. Just, you know, earn your way back up to the title shot and stop just kind of feeling sorry for yourself up to, you know, on your way to another title shot.
Yeah, I mean, if the shoe was on the other foot, Cody wouldn't be giving TJ a title shot here. He told him he had to earn it. He knocked him out. He still needs to recover, probably recovering from brain damage. And I'm with you. I got tired of the whole rivalry between them, the crying from not only Cody but his entire camp as well. Although, well, you broke up the camp and family. Shut the fuck up. You know, you got TJ Dillashaw when he beat Rene Barrio for the title at UFC 173. He defended the title twice before losing that close decision, then had to beat Rafael Sanchon, John Lineker to get him, and then had to do a stint on the Ultimate Fighter opposite Cody Garbrandt before he could get a title shot there. So for Cody, not even defending the title once and being finished in the fight, I definitely feel that he needs to earn his way back up there. As you said, maybe if it's just one fight, okay, but still, you know, I understand that it would be a big fight and it would be something that could save it, but Cody is certainly not in the position, I feel, to making those type of demands. So kudos for TJ Dillashaw for holding his ground. Unless the UFC does what they did with Daniel Cormier and throw a truckload of money at him, maybe he'll change his mind. But I think TJ is looking at the bigger picture here and seeing DJ as the real big fish out there for him to try and go grab. So might as well stay focused and go after that. So kudos for him in that particular call. Unfortunately, we do got to talk about something that's very, very saddening to hear, but it is the case. Or as this fighter would say, it's normal. UFC great, maybe considered one of the greatest fighters of all time, if not the greatest fighter of all time. Anderson Silva was flagged late last year for a potential PED violation by USADA. It has come back as a positive. He did test positive for a steroid diuretic in October. This is Anderson Silva's second offense for PEDs in a short period of time. This isn't like he popped hot, you know, several years ago and it's coming back to bite him later. It's happened in the last couple of years. We saw, I believe it was 2015 against Nick Diaz, that he popped hot for another steroid PED substance abuse, you know, dick pills from the gas station. And now this one. What do you make of Anderson Silva possibly tarnishing his legacy with this second PED violation?
Yeah, at this point, man, like, if there's smoke, there's fire. And I think, you know, even after one test failure, I think if I recall correctly, Anderson Silva tested positive for four different types of steroids when he tested positive the first time against Nick Diaz. And, you know, he said it was you know, dick pills or whatever. And even then, a lot of people were questioning, you know, the rest of his career. You know, has he been doing it his entire career, or is this just a one-time incident? But now, you know, it happens a second time under USADA this time, and it is another steroid. It's not like he's, you know, testing positive for you know, something less egregious than steroids. I mean, it is just flat-out steroids that he's taking, and a diuretic on top of that. I mean, as I said, where there's smoke, there's fire, and I think that really tarnishes Anderson Silva's legacy, and it certainly makes me wonder whether he's been doing this throughout his entire career, and it is unfortunate. I think, you know, once Anderson Silva lost his belt to Chris Weidman, there was a significant drop-off in performance for him, and man, at that point, he probably should have just thought about retirement, you know, somewhere somewhere in that streak of fights, because he hasn't necessarily looked all that impressive, and he's failed two different steroid tests at this point. So at this point, his career is not really looking any better, and his legacy is completely tarnished. So, man, I really don't want to hear about anything else that's going to put a black eye in his career, because, as you said, he was at one point considered the greatest of all time, and I don't think anybody's really putting him on top of any of those lists anymore, considering everything that's happened. So it's just a sad story, you know, to hear, but what can he do? I think at this point there is no coming back for Anderson Silva. I think the suspension is going to be so long that, you know, by the time it's over, he's going to be too old to even return. So, unfortunately, I think we have seen the last of Anderson Silva.
It is very unfortunate for him. You know, one of the most talented fighters we've ever seen step inside the cage. Truly a remarkable striker. But, you know, 42 years old, and if the UFC, if USADA takes his previous suspension into effect, because if I'm not mistaken, I don't think USADA was there for his 2015 suspension after the Nick Diaz fight. I'm not sure if they were in effect yet. Yeah, so if they take that into effect, he could face up to a potential 4-year ban and come back at 46, 47. Yeah, I just don't see that being the case. But if they don't, and they make this a first-time offender, could be a year that he's suspended, and whether they want to do, you know, obviously he'll do an appeal, and then all the time that it takes for that, will they do time already served? We shall see. But this is a man who held the title for over 2,200 days, defended the title 10 times, UFC records up until, you know, Demetrius Johnson broke it. But, you know, truly one of the most physically gifted fighters we've ever seen, with his capoeira style, his Spider-Man-like reflexes and counter-punching, and really, you know, another guy who was not overly bulky and strong, didn't throw a lot of haymakers, but it seemed his accuracy and timing was so effective that when he tagged you, it really, like, put you on queer street. No offense to anybody that might take offense to that term, but he really put you on roller skates. So it's unfortunate, but you know what? At the end of the day, rules are rules, and if you break them, it is what it is as far as how you look at. Personally, just me, I'm not going to look at him any less, but I will say I necessarily can't say he's the greatest of all time now. Now, let's say, you know, the agreement with USADA and the UFC in a couple of years comes up, and the UFC surprisingly doesn't want to renew the contract. They get rid of him, and they say, hey, everybody, we're going to be, quote-unquote, clean. USADA just ain't going to be here to make sure, so let's go. You know, maybe then you can kind of look at it and say, okay, Vitor, somehow you're 50 years old with a body of 25-year-old. Got it. It's that Jesus juice. Go ahead and fight. Who knows? But until things are different, it is what it is. The spider, certainly, you know, he's done enough in this sport to where his legacy will always be one of the greats. But to have two failed drug tests on your resume is certainly not good. And people talk about John Jones. And, you know, obviously we're going to find out what's going on with his situation shortly here. But Anderson Silva really, really, he didn't shoot himself in the foot here. And he already broke his leg. He didn't mess around, put one in his thigh where he almost hit that one fatal artery that he just can't recover from. So we'll see how it turns out for the spider going forward. Not sure, you know, if things come out. But, man, it is it's very sad and unfortunate that he had to do this. No disrespect to the country itself, but ever since they started putting this USADA in, fighters from all over the world have been popping hot, but there's been a high percentage of fighters, you know, kind of south of Florida, if you know what I mean, that has been popping hot. All I'm saying I'm glad that you guys love the sport, you're very passionate, but you know, that ain't coconut water, that ain't just coconut water y'all down there drinking. Leo, one last thing before we wrap up the show here. Earlier we were talking about guys like Nate Diaz. Is he just trolling the UFC? We're trying to come back. Speaking of trolling, the King of trolling, he's been on fire these past couple of days. I know you've heard about it, Leo, but there have been three posts of Floyd Mayweather teasing an octagon debut. One was him entering the cage, would look like it was at Syndicate MMA gym, if I'm not mistaken. No shirt, shorts, no socks, no shoes. Entered the cage, looked at the camera, nodded, walked the other way. He did another one where he was in the middle of the cage, warming up his hands, did a promotion for a company. And then another one, we posted a video of him in a fighting stance with UFC gloves on. Obviously, the UFC gloves said TMT on it. What do you make of Floyd Mayweather's continuous octagon debut trolling? Fair, foul, wet dreams, or is he kind of hinting at some big news we might be hearing coming?
Man, I really don't know what to make of it. I did see one where I think he said Floyd Mayweather MMA 2018, and then he walked away. But it's really not saying anything. I mean, Floyd has been talking about wanting to get into the MMA game as far as promotion goes. And, you know, the UFC has been talking about getting that Zuffa boxing thing going. Again, I got to think it's something to do with the UFC and or at least Zuffa boxing and Floyd Mayweather kind of getting together and putting promotional assets together. I don't believe for a million years that Floyd at 40-something years old is thinking about making his MMA debut, because I think that would be very tarnishing to his legacy. I mean, let's just be real here. I think if Floyd were to step into the octagon, even if it were against a guy like CM Punk, I mean, he's probably going to get his ass beat. And I don't think that would be good for the 50-0 legacy that he's worked so hard to build throughout all these years. So I don't think that's a Floyd move at all. You know, Floyd doesn't really play where the rules are fair. He always wants to put, you know, all the he wants the rules to favor him, and the, you know, MMA rules don't favor him at all. So it's just not something that would be characteristic of him to want to step into the octagon and try to make his MMA debut, even if it was just a one-off, even if it was a $300 million fight. I don't think it's really worth it for him to have that loss in any kind of record. So I do think it is mostly trolling, and I do think it is just setting people up for the disappointment of, oh, I met Floyd Mayweather MMA 2018 in promotion, not in fighting, which, you know, I think people should be used to Floyd Mayweather doing that, you know, throughout his whole career. I don't know why people keep falling for those tactics over and over again. If you recall, when before he fought Marcos Maidana, Floyd Mayweather said, I'm going to let the fans pick who I'm going to fight next. And it's just going to be like a voting poll on my website. And people thought, oh, maybe we got the Manny Pacquiao fight. Well, no, because there was only two choices. It was Marcos Maidana and Amir Khan. So everybody votes for Amir Khan, and then he says, oh, I'm going to fight Marcos Maidana. So that's just Floyd Mayweather doing what Floyd Mayweather does. He just trolls people, and even if people are pissed off, they're still going to tune into what he has to say because he's that interesting of a character. But man, I do not believe for a second that he's going to fight in MMA. And if he does, I mean, I'll eat my words, but, I mean, do you believe this is going to happen? I really don't.
Well, I mean, to a certain degree, when he gave the option for picking Maidana or Amir Khan, he did kind of let the fans choose. And, you know, if you remember, after the first fight, even though the fan poll did favor Khan, after the first fight, there were a lot of people who thought Maidana beat him. And as we know, a lot of fighters feel, hey, if you thought the guy just fought beat me, even though I clearly know I'm the better fighter, I'll rematch him. So, yeah, there's that. Floyd is obviously a master manipulator. He, if he could somehow get his hand on the Captain America syndrome that turns Steve Rogers into Captain America, I think he'd be perfect for something like the WWE, you know, where he could just go in there, get on the mic, let it rip. He'd be the ultimate heel to everybody, win Money in the Bank, cash it in. But in all fairness and being serious, I do completely understand, and trust me, I'm at like 99.9% that he'll never, ever take a UFC fight. But again, I do also look at it from this sense. Floyd is a businessman. He loves his money, and we know WME, they want big fights. So if somehow, some way, they made a special occasion where they would allow Mayweather Promotions to co-promote a UFC fight with Floyd Mayweather involved, Floyd has shown time and time again throughout his career in boxing, no matter what, outside of my very last fight at outside of my 49-0 fight against Andre Berto, fans tune in record numbers to see me fight. And who wouldn't tune in to see Floyd Mayweather step in the cage, most likely knowing the end result? So if he got into MMA, his 50-0 record would be perfect in boxing still, and he would try something else, kind of like Muhammad Ali in professional wrestling back in the day. Different circumstances, I know, and that was a draw, but you know what I'm saying? I could somewhat see him maybe considering it. You know, it's not like he's going to do a full career in the UFC. And again, if he was to take on someone like a Conor McGregor, obviously we know of the ground game and jiu-jitsu. How many takedowns has Conor McGregor gone for in his career? The one against Nate Diaz when he got tagged in the first fight, and one against Max Holloway after we found out afterwards he tore his ACL. So it's not like Conor McGregor is going to go in there and Chad Mendez or Randy Couture him and just double leg him to the ground. He's going to, now the kicks and the elbows and the knees, sure, but still in all, a lot easier to adjust to the stand up even if you got thrown the other stuff as opposed to learning everything. So I think if he, you know, if he practiced and trained correctly for Conor McGregor, and if the UFC was willing to do it, imagine how much money he could make then from co-promotions, ticket sales, pay-per-view buys, that big payday. We know Floyd loves his payday. Now he'll have the record for not only highest payday in boxing, but highest payday in MMA as well, a sport he's not even in. So,
yeah.
Again, I'm at 99.9% that it won't happen. But we also said that about Floyd versus McGregor in boxing, and look what happened.
Yeah, I mean, I will admit that I was one of the those people who said, you know, Floyd Mayweather and Conor McGregor are absolutely never happening in a million years. Sure enough, a few months later, it's happening. Man, I think the only scenario I could possibly imagine where Floyd is in an MMA fight is against another full-time boxer. You know, maybe he does like a rematch against Manny Pacquiao, quote-unquote MMA rules, but it's probably just going to be two guys boxing anyway, right? They're just going to be using smaller gloves and no shoes, right? So I really don't see any scenario because, I mean, he's not going to fight an elite MMA fighter, right? So an elite MMA fighter is the only other guy who'd probably draw in the numbers as much as Floyd does. But, I mean, like even a Conor McGregor, as you say, those kicks or the knees and the punches, those come into play. And why wouldn't Conor McGregor want to take down Floyd Mayweather? I mean, if it's part of the rules, and, you know, Floyd Mayweather has probably 0 hours of wrestling takedown defense or any kind of jiu-jitsu, whereas Conor has, you know, infinite numbers of hours. So there's no scenario that I can imagine where Conor wouldn't take Floyd Mayweather down in an MMA fight. And then if Floyd were to go against like an amateur level MMA guy, he'd probably still lose, and then he would lose against a no-name nobody. So that would be even, you know, that would be insult to injury. So I think the only thing that I can possibly imagine is some kind of deception where Floyd says, yeah, I'm going to do MMA. Oh, but by the way, I'm going to go against another guy who doesn't know anything about MMA, like Manny Pacquiao. And we're just going to quote unquote do MMA, but really we're just going to be boxing in small gloves.
Yeah, I could see that being a possibility. But honestly, I think Dana White would so want to get payback for McGregor losing. And he would say, Floyd, you're not fighting anybody now named Conor McGregor. I'm sorry, if you really want to do this, we'll work
well,
everything out.
Not fighting anybody.
Conor McGregor. No, and that's very true. But at the same time, you know, I get what you're saying. Honestly, I really don't. I don't see Conor McGregor going that route of, well, why wouldn't I take him down? Because I think Conor McGregor, you know, say what you will about him, I think Conor McGregor does have that true warrior fighter spirit of, I'm going to fight him. I'm going to beat him with what I do best here. And I'm going to show him this quote-unquote Bruce Lee shit. And I think Conor wouldn't go in there looking to take him down, because then people could say, oh, well, of course he would do that. You're too scared to stand up with him, because if Floyd lands one punch, we know what would happen. I think Conor would say, oh, yeah? Let me show y'all what happens when I land one punch and it's out the gun. They go night-night. Everybody go night-night. So, yeah, again, I'm at 99.9% chance it will never happen. But I got to tell you, Floyd does keep it interesting with these posts. I love it. It's enjoyable, and it keeps something going. So, Leo, man, once again, thank you for coming on for the show.
Thank you.
Unfortunately, we couldn't get David on here, but again, I know he'll be on in the future. We'll be looking to get some more guests coming on here as well. Do you have any final thoughts or want to promote anything as far as any events that you know of coming up, EBI events or combat jiu-jitsu, or let people know where they can find you on social media before we cut loose?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a EBI 15. It's going to be the featherweights coming up on February the 17th, I believe. And it's going to be in Los Angeles. So look forward to that. And find me on Twitter at ShowerLeo.
All right, man. Leo, once again, thanks for coming on. Good stuff as always. Everybody, be sure to tune into our show, Inside the Octagon, every Monday from 3 to 4:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Find me on Twitter at KLUA11, KLUA11. Also, follow my sports page on Facebook. That's All Things Sports. Again, congratulations to the Philadelphia Eagles for bringing home the title. Patriots, ha-ha. But all in all, thank you guys for tuning in. Enjoy the fight. Enjoy the week. Until next week, everybody. Peace.
Just Blaze. Oh, baby. Chillin'. All the girls see the. Look at his kicks. Look at his car. All I say is. Look, mommy, I'm no good. I'm so hood. Clap at your soldier. Sober. That leaves after it's over. Killer. I'm not your companion. Or your man standing. Hit me when you wanna get rammed in. I be scrambling. With lots of monsters. Shot for lobsters. Cops and robbers. Listen, every block is blocked. But she liked the way I diddy bop. You peep that. Mink on Maury kicks. Plus Chanel ski hat. She want the. So I give her the. Now she screaming out. Killer. Killer. Playing with herself, can't dig it.